This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Duke University recently received a $15 million grant to fund new research into brain disorders, including autism. The project is the latest in the university's expanding approach to autism diagnosis and treatment. Autism has not always been in the headlines. When Jerry Dawson decided to study the condition, few people received a diagnosis and little was known about its causes or treatment. Jerry Dawson has devoted more than three decades of her career to the study of the disorder, and today she heads the Duke Center for Autism Diagnosis and Treatment. Jerry Dawson, welcome to State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Tell us about your early interest. When did you first develop an interest in the way the brain works?
Well, my first case that was assigned to me as a graduate student when I was learning my clinical skills was a young child with autism. And you have to realize that at that point in history, autism was still a very rare condition.
That point was 1970?
This was in the late 1970s. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it was so rare that when this child came through the clinic, that University of Washington, where I was a graduate student, decided to have what's called a grand rounds. That's where you bring in everyone to try to understand something together. And we flew in what then was one of the leading experts in the country, and that was Dr. Eric Schoppler from University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. So you may know that there's the TEACH program there that Eric Schoppler established. So Eric Schoppler flew to the University of Washington, and we all put our heads together to try to understand this little boy. And two things struck me. One is that at that point, we knew very little about what parts of the brain are responsible for social interaction, for forming relationships. And so it was a real mystery how it could be that a child could come into the world and not be able to relate socially to other people. I felt that if we understood that, not only could we help this little boy and his family, but we would also learn something very important about the human brain and about ourselves and human nature.
You were thinking about it at that point from kind of from a behavioral standpoint.
Right. From a neuroscience or brain perspective, very much always interested in the brain and what is the brain basis that could explain. I mean, we knew that autism was a biological condition, but we just didn't know anything about the parts of the brain that help us recognize faces and interpret facial expressions and so much that we now know. But the second thing that really struck me was that we really didn't have anything we could offer this family at that point. We didn't have very good therapies. Now, of course, Dr. Schoppler and others were just beginning to develop some of their treatment approaches. But we just didn't have many tools at that point to help the family. So I decided then and there that this was what I would devote my career to. And as I went to my doctoral committee and I said, you know, this is what I want to study, I remember one of my professors looked at me and said, well, you chose a very hard problem.
A hard problem in a sense because it's a complicated one, but also because it's at that moment in history, very, very rare, right?
That's right. In fact, I sort of imagined myself as being this expert that would see, you know, most of the cases, for example, in the Northwest. You know, I might be the Northwest expert in autism. You know, I just couldn't have ever imagined what happened in the next, you know, number of decades and how our understanding has changed, but the prevalence has changed. So many things about the autism have changed over the last several decades.
I want to talk more about those changes, many of which you have been in the center of many of those changes. But when did you develop an interest in this in the first place? You said you were a grad student in psychology, so clearly the brain and our behavior interested you even before this.
Well, actually, my very first experience with a child in this case had two children with autism was in high school. So I lived across the street from a family that had twins with autism. And it also had an older sister and a grandfather who lived in the home. And the mother was taking care of her sick husband, and he needed dialysis. And every weekend, she would have to go and get his treatment. And I would take care of that family in the weekends. And that was my first experience. And I became very interested in, you know, individual differences, how it is that the brain develops differently in different people, how might we be able to help people so that if they have a disability that they have the best outcome possible. But I was also very struck with the mother, and I was inspired by her. Her compassion and everything that she did for those kids and the rest of the family. So she really stuck in my mind, and wanting to work with those families and to help was very compelling to me.
A lot of science in your family growing up, right?
That's right. So my father was a physicist, and was a nuclear physicist, and I grew up near Hanford Nuclear Power Plant in southeastern Washington. And my mother was a nurse, and so I grew up around a lot of physicists, a lot of engineers, and a lot of healthcare professionals.
In the compassion industry, which is when you think about it as nurses, right?
So, yes.
And I guess when you think about autism, that's the sort of the meeting place. That's the nexus of those two things. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of science neurobiology, but it's the neurobiology of compassion, of social
right.
interaction. You became interested. Now, when we talk about autism, we talk about it as a single disorder, but it's a spectral disorder, right? And what do we know about it? Are we even confident now about our diagnoses because it's so complicated and so many different sorts of behaviors?
Well, it's important to keep in mind that autism is not one condition with one cause, but rather it is many different conditions with many different causes. But in all cases, there is an effect on the brain that makes it difficult to develop social relationships, to learn to communicate. And many people with autism have repetitive behaviors. So even though there's many causes, it's affecting the brain in a similar way. It's also very variable in terms of the severity and how it's expressed. So some individuals are able to have a job, and they are married and are very talented and able to live independently, whereas other individuals may never speak their entire life. About 30% of people with autism do not develop spoken language. We also have many people who struggle with medical conditions that are associated with autism, so seizures, GI conditions, sleep disorders, and even psychiatric problems like anxiety and depression. So a very large continuum, and that's sort of the diverse face of autism.
And how is it diagnosed? Is it behavioral? Are there neurobiological stamps that you can read?
Currently, autism is a behavioral diagnosis. We are looking for those early signs of difficulties in the area of social interaction. So, for example, in a young baby, what we see is a lack of eye contact, a inability to use certain gestures such as pointing and showing. Baby may not respond when they hear their name called. They may be playing with toys differently, so overly focused on some objects and not playing socially. So it is a behavioral diagnosis. But we're learning much more about the underlying genetics of autism. So we know that it has a large genetic component. And we're also learning more about the underlying neurobiology, what brain systems are affected. In fact, we're not only learning about the individual parts of the brain that we know are affected in autism, but we're even now discovering the underlying biology at the level of the brain pathways. We know that autism affects how brain cells make connections, what we call the synapses. And we're learning about the biology of how the synapse is disrupted in autism, and even beginning to develop medications that could help to restore the functioning of the synapse in a person with autism.
So that's interesting. It's not just perhaps structural differences in the brain, but in the way the brain functions, these connections between neurons, the way they're communicating with themselves.
That's right. In fact, at Duke University, in the Department of Psychiatry and in the Department of Pediatrics, are now conducting research using animal models of autism, where we're understanding the underlying biology at the level of the chemistry and developing medications that might restore those pathways and help a person with autism to function better.
But that's interesting, because if it was a problem, say, with firing, because the brain develops different than our bodies, we've got the whole body just tiny and it gets bigger, but the brain is actually making itself as it goes. If it's not connecting properly, then the structures may not develop properly. Am I right? Because they're not getting the right feedback?
Yes, that's right. So think about a baby who comes into the world and is not interacting with other people. So that means that that baby's brain is not getting the normal kind of stimulation in terms of the parts of the brain that are responsible for social behavior, for language. And so when we think about treatment, it's very important that we provide that stimulation. And in fact, that is what intensive behavioral intervention is for autism. And what we've discovered is that if we start early and we provide intensive behavioral intervention, that not only do we see a very positive impact on behavior, but we can also alter those connections in the brain. Wow. And we can measure that using techniques like EEG, where we look at the brain waves. And we've been able to show that we can restore those normal patterns of brain activity by providing early behavioral intervention.
Talking with Jerry Dawson, director of the Duke Center for Autism Diagnosis and Treatment, and our conversation continues on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, talking today with Jerry Dawson, director of Duke Center for Autism and Treatment. Whenever I hear anybody who's an expert in a field give symptoms on the air, I just think about the immediate panic you've caused for now young parents whose babies didn't gesture once or didn't look. When you talk about some of the symptoms that are key to early diagnosis, you've actually come up with ways to even help clinicians, doctors, interpret those results so that we're not all parents on our own scared because baby didn't look up once. Tell us about that, and use video too, which I think is fascinating technique for actually analyzing some of this infant behavior.
That's right. Well, just to kind of step back in history, we once thought that autism could not be diagnosed until age 3 or 4. And that's because we were focused on language and imaginary play, things that develop during the preschool period. But as we thought about autism and, say, the lack of eye contact, we thought at the University of Washington that we should be able to pick up those symptoms in a young baby. But how do you do that? Well, we decided, and this was the brilliant idea of one of my graduate students, and she did this project for her dissertation. We decided to look at home videotapes, and we looked at first birthday parties, and we had these videotapes from babies who later developed autism versus typical development, and we found that, indeed, you did see symptoms at 1 year of age. And they, as I said before, lack of eye contact, not using gestures such as pointing and showing things to the other person, and also failing to orient when your name is called. And so these kind of behaviors now have been validated in a number of studies and are now used as screening tools. So the American Academy of Pediatrics has now asked all pediatricians to screen all babies at 18 and 24 months for autism symptoms. And in fact, at Duke University, all babies are screened when they come in at 18 and 24 months. And it's a simple questionnaire that parents can fill out that asks questions about their baby's behavior. One difficulty, however, is that these questionnaires tend to over-identify the number of babies. So we call that false positives. In other words, we're telling a parent, you know, your baby might be at risk for autism when in fact about 50% of those babies are not going to have autism. Now, the reason that's a problem is because, of course, as you say, you know, parents will get very anxious. But also, we have long waiting lists to get those diagnoses. So at Duke in the Department of Psychiatry, we were asking ourselves, well, how could we help the pediatrician to do a better job and reduce those false positives? So Dr. Helen Ager and myself partnered with Guillermo Sapiro from the Department of Engineering. And we're developing a technique where we bring a tablet, such as an iPad, into the pediatrician's office, and we present on the tablet a little videotape that probes for the symptoms of autism. Now, the really neat thing is there's a camera in that tablet, so it's automatically recording the baby's behavior. And using these algorithms that the Department of Engineering and Dr. Shapiro's team has developed, they're able then to automatically code that baby's behavior on the tablet, and then we're going to feed that information back to the physicians so that they can make a more informed judgment. So we're now piloting this in Duke primary care.
So you don't know yet if you've actually reduced the false positives, but it does sound promising.
Yes, it's using technology really to help us do a better job. And the other thing that we're very interested in terms of these projects that are using technology is being able to provide some of these tools to people in rural communities, low-resource communities, and even throughout the world. So, you know, autism doesn't just affect people in the United States. People all over the world are struggling with finding enough professionals who know how to diagnose autism. So we hope that this will help in the long run with that problem.
How widespread is it, and do we know if it shows up sort of equally across the board in developed countries and less developed countries?
Well, we have good prevalence estimates, of course, in the United States, but also in Europe, also in Japan, Canada. But there are many places where we don't have good estimates. So many of the low-income countries, India, for example, Africa, we still don't have good prevalence estimates. Those studies are ongoing right now. But I can tell you that clearly people in those countries are, in fact, struggling with those issues in many countries throughout the world. So, for example, one project in the Department of Psychiatry at Duke that we're developing is a project where we're going into the villages of South Africa to be able to help parents there to deliver interventions themselves to children with autism because they don't have access to trained professionals like we do in the United States.
We talked about the increase in diagnosis for autism since the late 70s. What accounts for that? Is that just better diagnosis, or are we seeing more cases?
So you're right. We have seen really an explosion, really, of the prevalence of autism over the last several decades. And there have been some really good epidemiological studies that have parsed apart some of the factors that could have contributed to that increase. And what we know is that things like broadening the diagnostic criteria, better ability to pick up on milder symptoms, access to services, all of those things have influenced this increase in prevalence. But when you put all of those things together, it still does not account for the degree of increase that we've seen in prevalence. And that's why there's a great interest now in understanding whether there could be environmental risk factors that could have also contributed. So it's not going to be one smoking gun, but rather many, many factors coming together to lead to this increase. In fact, in North Carolina, we now estimate that 1 in 58 individuals are affected by an autism spectrum disorder.
Wow. How does that compare to the national average?
1 in 68, so wow. Slightly higher.
Yeah. So do we have any guesses now about the causes of autism?
So we do know that it is a combination of both genetics and environmental risk factors. So genetics provide a vulnerability, but these are combining with factors that probably are affecting mostly the prenatal period, but early postnatal period. And they could be things such as medications. They can be things in the environment, such as pollution. So a wide range of factors in the environment that may be interacting with what is a vulnerability that starts with genetics.
You talked about treatment, and you talked about certainly the early interventions that you have pioneered and have now. Many of them are standard. Things going on in places like South Africa, what are they? How much are parents involved in this? To what extent does a professional have to deliver some of these treatments? Tell us about treatment.
Well, what we've learned is that early intensive behavioral intervention makes a very significant difference in the outcome of people with autism. And I should say, by the way, that we're now considering a bill here in North Carolina where the state-regulated insurance plans would pay for these therapies, because currently, in many cases, parents are paying for these out of pocket, and they can be very expensive. But essentially, it involves working first one-on-one with a child where we're teaching them all the basic skills of interaction and language and play. So the model that my colleague Sally Rogers and I have developed, it's called the Early Start Denver model, and it uses principles of learning, what we call applied behavior analysis, but it does this in a very playful relationship-based platform. So really, if you were to watch this therapy, it would look like the adult is simply playing with the child, but they're very carefully teaching the child how to imitate, how to make eye contact, how to point, how to interact with their peers. And the really important thing is that this can have an impact not only on social development, but also on cognitive development. So the average IQ gain is about 17 points. That's over a standard deviation. So many children at the beginning of intervention would be considered having an intellectual disability, but by the end of the intervention, they do not. They go on to a regular classroom, develop peer relationships. Now, you asked about the role of parents, and parents are essential. Right from the beginning, parents are brought onto the team, and in fact, they're considered the lead of the team. They're at the helm. And we ask parents what their priorities are. But parents are taught to use these strategies throughout the child's waking day. Because if you think about a typical child, they are learning every single moment of the day, whether it's at mealtime or bath time or at the park. So we're teaching parents strategies that they can use that will facilitate social interaction, language play, that they can use throughout their daily routines. Sometimes these interventions are delivered primarily by parents, particularly if they don't have access to a professional. So we've written a book. It's called An Early Start for Your Child with Autism, which is a how-to book that parents can pick up and they can learn how to promote eye contact and interaction. But ideally, you also are working with a team of professionals that not only have expertise in behavioral intervention, but also are addressing some of the medical issues that kids with autism present with. So let me just give you an example. Many kids have problems with sleep. And as you know, if you have had children, if you have a problem with sleep, it's not only a problem for the child, but for the entire family. Parents are tired. Kids could be awake all night, have trouble falling asleep. Well, that child, when they come to therapy the next day, is not going to be able to take advantage of that therapy program. And so addressing these medical conditions, it could have to do with sleep, could have to do with eating issues, seizures. In fact, in the Department of Psychiatry at Duke, we're developing a comprehensive sort of medical approach where we take into account these medical issues as well as the behavioral issues. And we think of this as treating the whole child. So kids will be not only addressed in terms of their behavioral health, but also their physical health.
You talked about the value of early intervention, and that seems intuitive, particularly when we think about how quickly the brain develops early on. Is it ever too late?
Absolutely not. And one of the points that I try to always make as I'm talking to parents is that although, of course, we want to start as early as possible because we know that intervention is affecting how the brain makes those connections, we don't have any evidence that there's ever a point at which a door closes and that the child is no longer going to be able to respond to an intervention. In fact, we did a study at the University of Washington with adults with autism where we looked to see whether we could, first of all, rectify a problem that many adults with autism have, which is problems in face recognition. because people with autism don't spend a lot of time looking at faces and they don't become face experts like the rest of us. And so we had already shown that the parts of the brain that are responsible for face recognition were not really properly functioning. We could see this in our neuroimaging studies. So we taught adults with autism to become face experts. And they did this with a little computer program they took home every day over a period of weeks. And they did, in fact, learn how to recognize faces extremely well. But importantly, we were able to bring online those parts of the brain that weren't functioning properly, and they were able to be stimulated and then function normally. So we believe that there's plasticity throughout the lifespan.
Well, that's interesting because you just said you were able to bring online. In other words, you weren't getting another part of the brain to compensate to be a face reader because this part didn't work. You actually got the face recognition matrix, all those things that go into recognition to activate, to work.
That's right. And so one of the studies that we published that's looking at early intervention and its impact on brain activity was asking that question. So we knew children had done quite well, many of the kids, when they had been provided with early intervention. They had developed social skills, for example. And the question was, are they using some other part of the brain, or were we able, by providing early intervention, to bring online those parts that weren't working properly? And what we found by using EEG or measuring brain waves is that after intervention, many of the kids showed very normal brain activity. So those parts of the brain that before were not responding to social information now were responding in the same way that a typical four-year-old would. So we do believe that we can bring online those areas of the brain that are not functioning properly to begin with through early intervention.
I'm talking with the head of Duke's Center for Autism Diagnosis and Treatment on the state of things. Jerry Dawson has been at Duke for just under a year. Yeah, we've been talking a lot about what happened at UW, but you are here now. What brought you to the Triangle?
Well, I was first brought by my transition to a job at Autism Speaks. So I was at the University of Washington for 23 years, directed the Autism Center there, which was a treatment center as well as a multidisciplinary research center. Then I was recruited to become the first chief science officer at Autism Speaks, which is the world's largest science and advocacy organization, and oversaw the science program there. And then after about 5 years, I started to really miss being in the lab and working directly with families, being a clinician. And I began to look around for a good place to go. And honestly, Duke was just the best opportunity that I could have hoped for. They've got a great team of clinicians there. We're developing a clinical program that is, as I mentioned, bringing together both behavioral and medical approaches to treatment, but also just a wide range of research that's being conducted at Duke and many of those projects I'm involved in now. So very cutting-edge work going on there, and I'm very excited to be there.
Not only that, but you met your husband here, right?
Yes, many years ago. So my first assistant professorship right out of after my internship at UCLA, was here at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And I met my husband here, and we've been together ever since.
Now, wait a minute. Because we've been talking some really fantastic science, neurobiology, behavioral therapies, going from autism being an obscure disease to one of the better understood, and now in this state, 1 in 58, a lot of science. Tell us the story about your husband and the YMCA and the pie. I want the pie story.
Oh, my. Okay. Well, so I did meet my husband swimming at the YMCA, and he did approach me in the parking lot after that swim and invited me to his house, and I did bring a peach pie, and it was no turning back from that.
It was the peach pie that did it.
It was the peach pie.
There's lots more science ahead. My guest this hour, Jerry Dawson, she is the director of the Duke Center for Autism Diagnosis and Treatment. We'll talk about that and about a $15 million grant that's going into some brain research, which includes autism research. recently announced, and we'll talk about where that where some of that funding is going and where the future of autism research is going when our conversation continues on the state of things. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with Jerry Dawson today, clinical child psychologist and director of the Duke Center for Autism Diagnosis and Treatment. Tell us a little bit more about your time with Autism Speaks, because you did a lot of testifying before Congress. So it was a lot of advocacy work there. Tell us about the work you were doing at the time.
Well, I was very interested in being able to work on the policy level and to hopefully be able to translate some of the research that we had done, say, for example, on early intervention and treatments into the real world. So, you know, you do a lot of research, you publish, and those publications sit on the shelf. But until it impacts things like, how the American Academy of Pediatrics telling pediatricians they have to screen, or providing insurance coverage for treatments, until it is translated into the real world, it's not going to have the impact that you want. And so that we did a lot of that work, not only here in the United States, but also internationally. So Autism Speaks is working in about 35 countries worldwide. So we did a lot of work in India and Africa, China, but also here in the United States. So as an example of one of the advocacy efforts I was involved in was to pass a bill that would provide better care for families in the military. So you think about a family who is in the military, they're moving from place to place. And what was happening is when they would move to a new place, they would have to get at the back of the line for all of the services, you know, that their child required. And I think I haven't said this explicitly, but there are not enough professionals right now to meet the demand for services. And this is throughout the lifespan, not only for children, but also for adults. And so these families were really struggling. And, you know, I heard some very heartbreaking stories about families where, you know, the father would be, you know, over in Iraq. He would be on the front line. Mom was home by herself with a child with special needs, taking care of that child, and then, you know, not getting the services they need. So that was one of the very gratifying bills that we passed. But many others as well. When we think about, for example, the CDC and the prevalence estimates that we now know, or most of the major research that's going on that's funded by NIH, that came from advocacy, that came from parents, really, who helped to pass bills that required that the government do surveillance studies, that fund studies. And so my role was to testify to the U.S. Congress to get these bills passed. But really, I have to give the credit to the parents. They're the ones that have really pushed this legislation and made it happen.
Do we think the prevalence rates have peaked, or are they still rising?
Oh, boy, that is the million-dollar question. Mm-hmm. You know, it's hard to know. It doesn't seem to be abating yet. The good news is that at least we can measure it now. We have the CDC that is carefully measuring this over time, so we'll have a good sense of it.
There is a debate in this field over whether autism, in a sense, ought to be cured, whether it is part of on the spectrum of human condition, and that we're looking at a kind of rate of neurodiversity here. How do you feel about that?
Well, that you're right. That is a controversial topic, I would say, that people have very different perspectives on. And as the chief science officer at Autism Speaks, I heard many different viewpoints on that issue. Just to give you a sense of this, let me tell you a story. When I was chief science officer, and the very first talk that I gave was at the International Meeting for Autism Research in London. And I was talking about all the different research that we were funding, because Autism Speaks funds about $25 million worth of research annually. And I was talking about genetics and neurobiology. And at the end of that, a man with autism stood up, and he was livid. And he said, "Why are you doing this research? I don't need to be cured. I need to be accepted for who I am. And then another man in the audience stood up, and this man started yelling at the first man, and he said, "My brother has autism. My brother has terrible seizures, cannot talk, is so sensitive to sensory information that he cannot go to the mall. And I want that to be cured, right? That disability to be cured. Not necessarily right. the talents of autism,
right.
but those, the epilepsy, the difficulties in sensory processing." And the two of them almost came to blows, mm. literally. And I just sort of thinking on my feet, I said, you know, we're really, first of all, what this diversity of perspective represents the diversity of autism, right? All the different faces of autism. But the common denominator is that we don't want people to suffer because of autism. And for one person, suffering had to do with being discriminated against, not accepted, not having employment, not being able to use the amazing talents and gifts that come with autism. And for another person, it had to do with these serious medical conditions. And there wasn't a right or wrong.
Right.
It really has to do with this complexity that we see in autism.
Do we lose sight of some of the gifts that that people with autism may have?
We absolutely do. And one of the most important things that we need to do as a society is to find a way for people with autism to utilize their talents. Currently, when people with autism leave high school, they often talk about it as falling off a cliff because there are no services and often no employment. And the majority of adults with autism are sitting at home and doing nothing. They're not using those talents. And yet we know from the people with autism who have been employed and have been able to use those gifts that they've been able to develop art and things like Temple Grandin's has developed wonderful techniques for handling livestock, that you can use these special talents in ways that offer society things that we can't offer in any other way. So it's so important that employers understand that people with autism have a tremendous amount to offer, and we need to find a way to get people out into the workforce and have productive lives. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges we face right now.
Yeah, and I think now you've really underscored the complexity of this whole question of neurodiversity, the talents that we might be losing if you can't get past the job interview, if we don't understand better, and that, in fact, what we call a disorder may, at another end, be a kind of a genius. On the other hand, if there are environmental factors, things that we're doing to ourselves that are causing this, we certainly don't want to stop the research into what might be environmental factors that affect other people very differently.
That's
and so
right.
we need to get to the bottom of it and,
yeah.
and all of these things. It argues, it seems to me, for bringing the stakeholders, for bringing people with autism into the discussion and making sure that they are stakeholders at the table when we talk about research and treatment and therapies and coverage and all that kind of thing.
Oh, that's critically important. So at Autism Speaks, for example, even on our scientific advisory boards, which were the boards that made decisions about grants, and we had people with autism on those boards. And at the Duke Center for Autism, we also will have people that are helping to shape the way in which the center is built. And I think it's so important to have people with autism right in the advisory capacity, no matter what we're doing. Yeah.
Tell us about this grant, that this $15 million grant that has come to Duke. Part of that will go to autism research. Tell us about it, please.
Well, we're very, very excited about this new award from the Marcus Foundation. So this is a $15 million award that is part of a anticipated $41 million five-year project. And it is a collaboration between the Department of Psychiatry and the Department of Pediatrics, and is headed up by Joanne Kurtzberg, who's a pediatrician, and myself. And we are going to be testing whether umbilical cord blood could be an effective treatment for autism, for other kinds of brain conditions, even cerebral palsy, and also stroke. And so the idea is that cord blood has some special cells. These are called stem cells. And these are cells that can become many types of cells. And in this case, we are hoping that they are going to make their way into the brain and promote the connections between cells and the creation of cells. And we have evidence from other conditions that Dr. Kurtzberg has studied that, in fact, this does happen, that these special stem cells that exist in cord blood can promote neuroplasticity. They also have another effect that's important. And we have one of the findings in terms of the neurobiology of autism is that there appears to be what we call neuroinflammation. So the brain is having an inflammatory response. And these stem cells also dampen that inflammation. And we know that by dampening that inflammation, that this helps cells to function properly. So we'll be conducting several clinical trials, and we'll begin by studying what's called autologous cord blood. That's the child's own cord blood, where parents have banked the cord blood. But eventually we hope to study the effect of a donor's cord blood because, of course, if it's effective, we want it to be accessible to everyone, and not every family has banked their child's cord blood.
There is more and more of that. Physicians and hospitals now are encouraging parents to do that.
That's true, but often parents need to pay for this themselves, and so we don't want to develop a treatment where it's only accessible to those that have the means and the income, you know, to have banked the cord blood. So our goal is, if it is found to be effective, and we're very hopeful, our goal then would be to be able to have donor cord blood so that it would be more widely accessible because there are very large banks of this donor cord blood.
Do you have to do anything with these stem cells, or do you simply introduce them and hope that they will act the way you were hoping the original equipment might have done?
It is really simply introducing them. So it is an infusion of the cord blood. And then we are following the children. These are 2 to 6-year-olds with autism, and we follow them over a year. And we look at their social behavior, their cognitive abilities. We're measuring brain activity in my lab. We're also looking at the development of the brain structure. So we're using MRI to look to see whether we can see changes in the pathways that connect one part of the brain with another. And as I said, we'll follow kids over a year, and we're very hopeful that this could have a positive impact.
We're meeting Jerry Dawson today on The State of Things. She's the head of Duke's Center for Autism Diagnosis and Treatment. What would that tell you if the introduction of cord blood, of the stem cells, could sort of correct some of the firing that's going on? What would that tell you about the nature of autism?
Well, we do have an interest in this neuroinflammatory effect, right? So we can see this by, for example, with an adult with autism, there are neuroimaging techniques that allow us to measure certain brain cells that we know are associated with neuroinflammation. These are called microglia. And what we see in the brain is that these are overactivated. Mm. And we now know that when that happens, that these cells are not functioning properly. So if, in fact, the introduction of stem cells and the reduction of this neuroinflammation, if that improves functioning, we'll also know something about the underlying mechanisms of autism.
I mean, it suggests that if that you are replacing, in a sense, please correct me because I'm about to be a scientist and that's dangerous, but that if there was an environmental factor, that it's not causing the new cell to have that effect. So it might mean that the original cell had been damaged or wasn't working right. Give me a new one and it'll be okay.
Yes.
It's not being influenced by whatever that factor was.
Exactly. You've got it right. Very good,
Every
Frank.
Once in a while, the junior scientist pulls it off.
Oh.
What about access to treatment? I suspect that income and wealth has something to do with whether or not you can have the proper treatment. Am I right?
Absolutely. And this is, I think, a major issue that we face not only in the United States but also worldwide is that many, many children and adults do not have access to services. And that's why we have to tackle this on many fronts. We've already talked about insurance reform and having insurance companies pay for services that we know are extremely helpful and cost effective. In fact, just to speak about the economics, we just did an economic analysis of the impact of early intervention. And we found that by age 10, that the early costs had been fully recovered. And that's because the children did not need as many special services as they went into elementary school age. So this is not only ethically important, but also really financially important.
Jerry Dawson, what a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Jerry Dawson is a clinical child psychologist and director of the Duke Center for Autism Diagnosis and Treatment. Thanks for listening to this program. Coming up just in time for July 4th, we're going to talk about patriotic films, your favorite or your least favorite. We want to hear from you. What is your favorite or least favorite patriotic movie? Weigh in. Give us an email, sot@wnc.org. Tweet us at #SOTMovie. And if you missed all that, just go to the website, stateofthings.org. It's got all the information. We'd love to have you on Movies on the Radio. Patriotic movies. Thanks for listening. The State of Things is produced by Laura Lee, Megan Modafferi, Anita Rao, and Will Michaels. Our intern, Charlie Shelton. Robin Copley is our technical director. Our news director is Brent Wolfe. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.